Anybody that has questions, come on up. Anything on the end times? We'll do this again. I've never done this before. I've had question and answer times, but never just on the cuff like this. We always planned them, you know, put it in the bulletin. Okay, we're going to even open this up to folks that are listening on the internet. And so if you're on the internet and you have questions, just send them to notes@ihop.org. Notes@ihop.org. And if you get them here in time, we got some folks who are going to look at them and ask them for you. So put your nation as well. Okay, we're going to go like this, back and forth.
Have you shared everything that you know about the end times, or are there secrets that you're not allowed to share yet?
Have I shared everything I know about the end times? No. Do I have any secrets? I don't think. I don't think I do. But I just not had the opportunity because, you know, I mostly stay at the introductory level on Saturday nights because most of the folks have only been here 3, 4, 5, 6 months. So I don't want to give real complicated concepts. And so I have lots of ideas I haven't shared on Saturday night. But Dave Schleicher knows them all. And so does Stuart. Okay, over here. And say your name.
Oh, Trish. Can you tell me what evidence there is that outside this, Israel's been given a nation?
Okay, now wait, say it again. I need a little bit more in the monitor here.
Can you tell me what evidence there is other than Israel getting its own land back? Because before the first coming, it had its land for a long time, coming and going from it. And I was here for your 10-year celebration, and I heard about the story for IHOP. What other evidence is there outside of those things for the end times being closer than further away?
Okay, so I'm going to rephrase it. The subject is signs of the times. And the Bible has quite a few signs that tell us the time that we're living in. And so your question was, besides Israel becoming a nation, that's one of the premier signs of the times, is Israel becoming a nation. Because for 2,000 years, they were not a nation. But the prophet said they have to be a nation before the end time purpose is fulfilled. And so for 2,000 years, scholars would say that it can't be. Israel will never be a nation. They will never overthrow the occupying powers. Ever. Never. Never. They don't have an army. They don't have an organized community anywhere of any stature enough to take over a nation. And so for Bible scholars for years just kind of gave up on it. And then suddenly in 1948, Israel became a nation. It was a shocking social development or political development because no nation in history ever has gone 40 years without a homeland and without a no nation has ever gone 40 years without a homeland and got back to their homeland. Some went out, you know, for 5 or 10 years and came back. But nobody's gone 40 years and retained a native language and got their homeland. So it's 2,000 years, not 40. So that's a huge sign of the time. That's one. A second sign of the time, and I'm only going to give one or two or three because I gave a series on it, and we have notes on the internet with about 20 signs of the times. The other one that's real major is the one in Matthew chapter 24, verse 14, where Jesus said that every nation will have a witness of the gospel. And right now, the biggest mission organizations of the world, let's say the top 50, they are in unity, the vast majority. There might be one that's not, but certainly the consensus is that is going to happen within 10 years for the first time in history. And so that's a huge... So Israel becoming a nation in the same generation that every nation has a witness of the gospel for the first time ever, those two both happening together. And there's quite a few others as well, but instead of me making this a teaching on the signs of the times, I'll just give you those two. Okay?
I have a question about the resistors. In Revelation 13, 16, and 17, where it says that the Antichrist makes all, both rich and poor, free and slave, to take the mark of the beast, how does the resistors fit into that verse?
Well, Revelation 13, verse 16 and 17, he makes all take the mark of the beast. That means if they want to be involved in the economic system. If they want to leave the system, then he can't make them. And so everybody that uses the economic system worldwide, the worldwide economic system, they have to do his system. But many will say no. It's just like in, again, a World War II, Nazi Germany, Hitler made a bunch of rules for Europe, and he occupied, the Nazis occupied France, but a bunch of the people from France said no. We don't want your economic system. We don't want your propaganda. We don't care about your way. We'll go out in the woods and do our own thing. So there will be plenty who'll do that. And the French resistance movement was not based on loving Jesus. It was based on nationalism. So it wasn't, there will be resistors that it's not because they love Jesus, because they hate the Antichrist and they love their nation. So there you go. And say your name.
My name's Chris, and I was wondering, in Revelation 14:10, it talks about those that receive the mark of the beast will be tormented in the
presence. Wait, can everybody hear his question? If you can't hear, wave your hand. Okay, so let's make that a little bit louder out there, yeah.
All right, so in Revelation 14:10, it talks about those that receive the mark of the beast will be tormented in the presence of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb. So is the lake of fire the absence of God's presence, or is it the fullness of his wrath? Like his presence, and expound upon it.
Yeah, so Revelation 14:10, they are in the lake of fire, but the angels are witnessing it. And so the question is the lake of fire the absence of God's presence, or is it the fullness of wrath? I would say it's the fullness of his wrath. Because even the verse in Psalm 139, it says, if you go down to Sheol, even my presence is there. I mean, the presence of God is everywhere. So I wouldn't think of the lake of fire as the absence, the one place in the universe God is not. I would say they don't connect with God. They don't enjoy his presence. It's not helpful to them. So it's the fullness of wrath.
All right, cool.
And again, if anybody wants to question, just get to the end of the line. And at any time, if you get one strikes you, just jump right in.
In Daniel chapter 12, I'm familiar with the 1260 days. But in verse 11, it talks about from the time the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there'll be 1,290 days.
Yes.
So that's an additional 30 days that we assume is the bowls
right.
And so forth. So then verse 12, it says, how blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. What's that extra 45 days?
I'm going to repeat it. So in Daniel chapter 12, it's clear from a bunch of Bible verses that there's 1,260 days. So 1,260 days, that's 3.5 years. That time frame is repeated over and over in prophetic scriptures. 1,260 days. But the angel comes and tells Daniel, hey, there's 30 more days. It's not just 42 months. There's a 43rd month. While it's after the rapture, but the Antichrist is still functioning for 30 days after the rapture. And so the question has been, you know, people have asked, what happens while the Antichrist is still functioning 30 days after the rapture? And, of course, we've addressed that several times. But your question is, the next verse, it says, it goes on and adds 45 more days to it. And what I assume, because there's not a lot of evidence as to exactly what it is, I think the 1,335 days, the extra 45 days, is a transition period where the nations are getting new leaders. New infrastructure is being put in place, so I just consider it to be the transition time in the millennial kingdom. Because it's not like Jesus comes, the Antichrist is over, he's done, even though he gets 30 days beyond the rapture to function. It's not like Jesus waves his hands and then everywhere in the nations, all of a sudden the new kings are in place. It still takes time, because it will be real people with natural bodies who have the places of government. So I think it's that 45 days the Lord is putting in leadership in every nation of the earth. That's what I assume is going on.
Hello, my name is Luke. I had a question on your vision from Revelation 12 and Revelation 6.
And you guys can hear, right? If you can't hear, wave your hand. Okay, good. I'm just kind of nervous. You can't hear, but you can.
And it was just a thought because of Isaiah 34 that in Revelation 6 it says, the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. And I was wondering if you thought that the stars of heaven could be, in fact, at that point, the demons being cast out of heaven.
So the question is, in Revelation 12, verse 7 to 9, it says that there's going to be a war in the heavens. In Revelation 12, verse 7 to 9, there's actually a war where Michael the archangel fights with Satan. This is literally going to happen in the future. And all the demons get cast to the earth from the mid-heavens. They're all thrown to the earth, Satan included. I mean, that is a radical concept that every single demon that exists, they'll either be in the pit or on the earth roaming. None of them are in the mid-heavens where many of them are now. They will be on the earth causing torment to people. It will be as close to hell on earth as possible. And so your question from Isaiah 34 is, there's a passage in Isaiah 34 that says the stars fall down. Could those stars be the demons? Because there's a verse in Revelation 12 where the demons are signified as stars.
And also in Isaiah 34 it says there's a sword that is bathed in heaven. And then it comes down on Edom. That's the main reason I thought.
Oh, because of the verse where the sword is bathed
in heaven and it comes down on Edom right after it says that the stars.
So the question is, are the stars demons or are the stars stars?
I was wondering what you thought.
My opinion is the stars are stars. Just because of the Revelation 6:12 verse. Because in Revelation 6:12, the stars fall down. And so I think it's related to that. Because it's right at the very end. And when Jesus is in Edom, which is modern day Jordan, killing people, that's when the blood is. That's at the end of the tribulation, whereas the Revelation 12 is at the beginning of it. So that's why I would think it would be actual stars.
Thank you.
My name is Jan. My question is about the battle of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39, how it fits into the scheme of things timing-wise. And also I wanted to ask about when do you think or how might the temple be built?
Okay. So I'll do the first one, and if I space the second one out, go for it. Ezekiel 38 and 39, it talks about Gog and Magog. Okay, Ezekiel 38 and 39, that's a very important two chapters. Now, Gog is actually a title, like the Antichrist or like Caesar. It's not the guy's name. It's a title. And Magog is the nation, his primary nation, that is his resource. And so I think Gog is the Antichrist and Magog is his nation, his primary nation, because he has a nation, then he has the 10 nations. So Gog is either his own personal nation or it could be the 10 nations, because the book of Revelation makes it clear, as does the book of Daniel, that the Antichrist has a 10 nation come together confederation, which is his military base and political basis, 10 nations. And so Gog, Magog might be all 10 of them. Who knows? I think it's the Antichrist and his 10 nations. And I think the battle is going on for 3.5 years. The battle starts when there's peace in Israel. And the peace is they've made peace with the Antichrist. Because he's a world leader who's masquerading as a nice man, a shepherd of the nations. And they make peace with him. He gets his inroads into Israel. Then he takes his mask off. He goes, sorry, guys, I'm really against you. But now I'm entrenched in your nation. And so it goes on for 3.5 years, which is what I call the Armageddon campaign. Because the Armageddon battle is not a battle at the end, as many would say. My opinion is not. It's a 3.5 year campaign, of which the final battle is the battle for Jerusalem. Because the final battle is around the city of Jerusalem. That's clear from a dozen scriptures. And so that's what's going on there. Okay. So it's 3.5 years. Okay. And that Gog and Magog are warring against Israel and the nations. And then at the very end, what happens is the destruction of the Antichrist is the destruction of Gog. So whatever Ezekiel 38 and 39 talks about how Gog gets destroyed, that's insight into how the Antichrist is destroyed. Good. Wait, another question.
What was about the temple?
I think the temple has paradoxes, because the temple is bad and good. There's several verses that make it clear that God has a purpose around that temple, because the two witnesses, the two greatest prophets in history, they are ministering in context to it. But the Jewish leaders are offering sacrifices that the Lord does not honor. To offer sacrifices in that temple is an abomination. So there are ungodly Jewish leaders offering sacrifices that offend God, and they are not at all, those sacrifices are not accepted. But the temple has a purpose. It's not called the temple of the devil. It's called the temple of God. That's what God called it. So it's kind of a paradox, and to me it's mysterious how it can have both dimensions. And so your question is, how is it going to get established, or?
When?
That's another sign of the times, is the fact that suddenly, of course, it's because Israel became a nation in the last 60 years, but the Bible makes it clear, the prophecies, that the temple has to be built and the sacrificial system has to be functioning. And right now in Israel, there is tremendous, I mean aggressive energy to get that sacrificial system established and functioning. I mean, that isn't a sign of a time by itself. I mean, that wasn't happening 100 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. That's only been true for a few years. And it's true the same time these other things are true. So that's a sign of the time. I don't know how they're going to make it happen. They will make it happen. And it won't be pleasing to the Lord, but he'll use it because he does not receive those sacrifices.
Okay, so we have two questions. Same question asked twice by two different people. Kelly in Canada wants to know, she says, my son would like to know if you believe that the two witnesses will be Elijah and Enoch. And then Chad from Texas says, talk to me about Enoch and Elijah coming back.
Oh, two questions. They happen to be the same.
Same question, yeah.
Oh, so that's
talk to me
question.
About Enoch and Elijah coming back as the two witnesses in Revelation 12. Will Elijah be back in the flesh?
Okay, good. So stay there in case I forget what they were. The questions were. Okay, there's two witnesses, right, in Revelation 11. And these are the two most powerful prophets ever, besides Jesus, of course. I mean, they go beyond Moses, beyond Elijah in power. But they're unnamed. And so nobody really knows who they are. And so then the next situation is several times, even from the lips of Jesus, but from the prophet Malachi, it's clear Elijah particularly is coming back. So we know Elijah's coming back, and we know there's two prophets. So people say, why can't one of those prophets be Elijah? And the answer is it could be. You can't know. We know for sure Elijah's coming back. But maybe it's two prophets plus Elijah. We don't know. If it's not two prophets plus Elijah, then clearly Elijah's one of them. But now the question is, who is the second one? And the reason people pick Enoch is because Elijah and Enoch are the only two men who have never died. Because if you remember in the book of Genesis, Enoch was walking with God and God took him. He just went up. And Elijah just went up. So those are the two guys who haven't died. And the scripture says it's appointed under man once to die. In Hebrews 9, verse 27, everybody has to die. So the prophecy guys through the years have said the only two guys that haven't died, two witnesses, must be those two. Well, there's a problem because there's going to be millions that don't die. It's called the rapture. So the idea that the two witnesses have to be Elijah and Enoch because they haven't died is kind of unconvincing, because millions that will be raptured never die physically. But having said that, it could be Enoch and Elijah, but we really don't know. So most guys say it's either Enoch and Elijah, or they say it's Elijah and Moses. Because the miracles in Revelation 11, that's where the two witnesses are described, verse 3 to 6, those miracles are the same miracles Moses and Elijah did. But we don't really know. So we know they're really two powerful guys. And we know Elijah's coming. So it's two plus one, or the two Elijahs, one of them. Did I get the whole deal?
That's it.
And who is that from where?
Chad from Texas and Kelly from Canada, and okay. Her son.
Kelly, tell your son I love his hunger for the Lord. Okay.
My name is Matt, and I'm wondering, in light of Matthew 25 and the sheep and the goat judgments, Jesus makes it clear that to those nations that have treated Israel, the least of his brethren, that he would do with them as if he was doing with them to himself. I'm just wondering, in light of just that scripture and in light of where we're at in terms of the Middle East crisis, how do you see the church's relationship in America changing or transforming with Israel, with that nation?
Okay, so we'll take two questions, right? So the first one's the Matthew 25. So I'm just going to tell everybody, just so their minds around your question. In Matthew 25, verse 31 and 32, Jesus comes back. And Jesus establishes his throne of glory in Matthew 25. I'm giving you the verses for those that are taking notes and want to write them down and check it out. So Jesus comes back and he sits on his throne of glory in Matthew 25, verse 31, 32. So now all the nations come before him and he judges them. And he has those that he calls sheep, and it's often referred to as sheep nations. And then there's goat nations. Now, we're not positive there is such a thing as sheep nations and goat nations, but many have that view, and it's believable that that's the right interpretation. But it doesn't actually say sheep nations and goat nations, but it could be true. I mean, it's believable, but I'm not convinced 100%, but it could be. But so what Jesus does is then he determines who are sheep and who are goats. In other words, who gets to be involved in the millennial kingdom and who doesn't, based on this criteria, how they treated my brethren. But the big debate, and it's a huge debate, who are his brethren? Is Jesus talking about how the nations treated the Jews? Or is Jesus talking about how the nations treated believers? Because born-again believers are his brethren. And those of the flesh of the bloodline of Abraham are his brethren. So which is it? Is it born-again believers his brethren? Or is his brethren Jews of the bloodline of Abraham? My guess is it's probably Jews from the bloodline of Abraham, but there's real smart guys and gals that debate that. So that's a passage that's really hard to land, really intense. My guess is what it means is he's talking to individuals and possibly nations about how they treat Israel in the tribulation. That's my opinion. That's a guess. So because Israel in the tribulation will be many of them, not all of them, Jews in the tribulation, many of them will be in prison camps and death camps. And so
Can you give us a scripture reference for that?
Yeah, there's lots, actually. There's quite a few of them. What's that?
Can you give us one?
Well, yeah, one. And I have on the internet, I think I have a document on it, like with the 25 verses that indicate it, with like maybe 15 of them are real direct, and another 10 of them are clear if you believe the first 15. Then the other 10, the implication's clear. One of them is Zechariah chapter 14, verse 2. It says that the nations, the Gentile nations, will surround Jerusalem. And they will do battle against the city, Zechariah 14, 2. And they will capture the city. And half of the population of Jerusalem will go into captivity, into slave camps. So that's one verse. So there's 600,000, nearly 700,000 in the city of Jerusalem. Most of them are Jewish. At the numbers of today, let's just say 600,000 Jews in Jerusalem, that would mean 300,000 from one city going to prison camps. And there's about 15 verses on it. So it's a highly unpopular topic at every level. I mean, it's like, what? But the Holocaust, I believe, and I say this with trepidation, that the Holocaust is going to happen again at a level beyond what happened in Nazi Germany. However, this time, what's going to happen is God is going to require the church to stand with Israel. And it's in very difficult situation that the nations are going to be judged on how they treated his brethren at that time. Did they ignore him or did they bring goodness to them? And so I think the church in Europe, for the most part, there's some really great examples that are opposite of what I just said, but for the most part, gave up Israel in the Holocaust and said, you know what, too hot, the potato's too hot, I'm backing away. But the Lord says, no, you cannot back away. I will require that my church stands with Israel. And it's in that context that the church will provoke Israel to jealousy, and they will want to know Jesus because of it. So that's now your next question.
Yeah, so that is in reference to Romans 11. That's how we're provoking Israel to jealousy.
You're saying
that the crisis creates the need to provoke.
Yeah, I think the crisis, we will provoke them because right now, because Romans 11, most of you are familiar with that passage, it says that the church is going to provoke Israel to jealousy. Well, 2,000 years later, Israel is not remotely provoked by the church. Maybe less than 1%. Most of Israel looks at the church and says, we're not at all provoked. And provoked means they look at the church and they go, we want the reality with God that you have. We are so awed by the way you know God, we want to know God. That's what it means to provoke Israel to jealousy. For 2,000 years, we're at the low, less than 1% level of success. So something is going to happen so dramatic that makes Israel worldwide, I mean the Jews around the nations, we want what you have with God. And that hadn't happened yet. That's still the future. So I think, like, Jews will be in flight, for instance. You'll take them in your home. And they'll think, first, why are you doing this? Because your life is in danger. And you're saying, because the God of Israel, his name is Jesus. They go, oh, no, not one of those. But okay, but I appreciate the free room. So I'll listen. But your life will be risked. And you're going to say, you know what? I live for the age to come anyway. They go, really? That's already provoked number one. Really? You mean the age to come is more real to you than right now? Yes. Whoa. Okay, we're listening a little bit. We're not convinced yet. So now there's 15 of you at the table, but there's only 10 potatoes. So you lay hands on them, and the potatoes multiply. For real. This is for real. And these Jewish unbelievers are going, that are hiding in your basement, they're going, hey, our guys did this. Like Elijah, Moses. Our guys did this, not your guys. And you're going to say, yeah. Your guys are the guys we joined. We were grafted into your guys. Yeah, it's your guys that are our role models. Moses, Elijah, and So then little Susie comes in and says, Daddy, Daddy, I had a dream last night. The bad guys are coming at 10 o'clock tomorrow. So at 10 o'clock, so you make you do something different. You don't wait there at 10 o'clock. Then at 10 o'clock, the bad guys come. And they go, how did your little daughter know that? Wait, our guys did that. We get dreams and visions, not you guys. And we're going to say, don't you get it? This is the root of Abraham. This is the tree. We're in the tree that belongs to you. And it's in that context, add a few more examples, that they will be provoked to jealousy. And at the end, they will say, we want your God. Because you say he's our God. And so that, it's a very exciting, but it will cause a lot of trouble for the church. That was a really long answer. You got another one, eh?
Oh, I got plenty. Okay, this is from Carl in Minnesota. He says, how can we know the harlot Babylon will be a religious economic belief system?
How do we know the harlot Babylon is a religious system? Because throughout the Old Testament, you know, I'm just making up the number. I don't quite know. The 30, 40, 50 times, it's a whole lot of times, that the harlot is used. It's always always in context to false religion. It's all because a harlot is a harlot because they had covenant with God, but they were not loyal to the covenant with God. And so that's why you know the harlot's never just immoral people. It's somebody who's breaking a covenant in their immorality. And the immorality is not so much physical sexual immorality, though that will be rife in the harlot Babylon. It will be spiritual harlotry where they are denying the God of Israel. They're denying the true God. And they're coming up with false gods and they're loyal to him. That's why the system is a harlot. And the harlot system will be made up of the religions of the world. I mean, Jews, Christians, the religions of the world will perpetrate this religion. And they will say, the Jesus we grew up with isn't the real Jesus. This is the real Jesus. And the Lord says, that's a harlot. That is a betrayal. And I think this is really intense. But I think, this is an opinion, I don't have where I can prove it, but I think that the primary leaders of the harlot Babylon will be Jewish. That it won't just be Christians, you know, from around the world, or Buddhists, or Hindus, or Muslims, they'll all be involved. I think the primary leaders on the front end of it will be Jewish, betraying the God of Israel, and God, in religious context, that's why he calls it a harlot. In my opinion, this opinion, I think the harlot Babylon will start originally the religion in the city of Jerusalem. That's my opinion. That's one of my little secrets. Someone said, do you have a little, it's not really a secret, but I don't really teach that much. But since it's just us and the internet, I just might as well just.
Just us and the nations over here.
So it's a harlot in that sense. So it is definitely a religious system over here.
My name's Tyler. I was wondering if the fire in 2 Peter 3:10 was the same fire as Revelation 29.
That's a great insight. I have never thought about that. No, I love that. Misty, she takes all the notes back there. But Revelation 20, verse 9 might be 2 Peter 3:10. She's back there. She's typing. No, that's great. Here's what he's saying. I've never put that together. That in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, I mean Revelation 20, verse 9, it's the end of the millennium, and the nation, the devil gets out of prison. And the devil stirs up people in the nations to come and attack Jerusalem again. So they come from around the nations. God sends fire down and consumes them. That's the very end of the millennium. The next thing we know is it's the new heavens and the new earth. So that fire comes down at the end of the millennium. But then 2 Peter says fire is at the end of the millennium. I just have never put the two verses together. I think it sounds pretty cool. I mean, it sounds like it could be right. Do you think it's right?
I don't know.
No, I think it could be. I've never thought about that.
Hey. That was a good one. My name's Jonathan. I also had a question about the resistors. It's kind of similar to what the lady asked, but I was also wondering about 13:8. It says, all who dwell on the earth will worship him. It's the beast. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb who has been slain. And I was just wondering, like, if everyone's worshiping the beast, how do the resistors fit around that? Everyone's worshiping the beast, and those who worship the beast, it says later, are going to burn in the lake of fire. Like, where does the all...
Okay, good. Yeah, great question. Revelation 13:8, it says they all worship the beast, except those names that are in the book of life. Now, the resistors end up getting saved. So the resistors' names are in the book of life. They're just not saved before the second coming, but they are saved for billions and billions and billions and billions of years.
Their names end up getting written in the book of life.
Their names end up in the book of life, right.
Thank you.
That took some pressure off, didn't it? Because you were thinking, man, these poor guys, there's no way forward for them. Good question, though. I struggled over that for a while, you know, some time ago. I thought, ah!
Here we have another dual question. This one, Tim from Canada again.
Same guy?
Different guy.
Okay.
Lots of friends up north watching tonight. Does the current economic crisis have any relevance to the end times? If so, how is it related? And then also from Peter.
Wait, let's just do one unless it's the
same question.
Question
twice. Oh, okay. Another one of those. Also from Peter, same basic, but he doesn't tell us where he's from. Are the current times of economic shaking a forerunner or example of the Revelation 18 events?
Okay. Is the current economic crisis related to the end times? I think it is. Not because it's going to get worse and worse. I don't think it's going to get worse and worse. I think it's the crisis is going to create a shift in policy that's dramatic. And it's the shift in policy will bail us out, assuming. I'm not saying this by the Holy Spirit. I'm just doing this by math. But far worse will be the shift in policies around the world. And, of course, we're seeing it in our nation right now with our president. A lot of shifts. But I think way more drastic than the ones happening now. I think that these are the beginning of the beginning. So I think that this is opening the door to radical new ways that nations do economics. And it's going to put us on this fast track, probably speed us up a decade or two, just on systems being in place for that ultimate negative system to function. My opinion, if I was guessing, I think it's 30, 40, 50 years out, personally. But that doesn't mean I'm right. And so I think those systems are being shifted now. And a couple major crises, you know, like the 911, but I mean far bigger than that, will also, that and economic crisis and terrorist attacks will shift things. And that is far more dangerous than the crisis that is at hand this very minute. Okay.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I was just wondering, in Revelation 1:5, Jesus is called firstborn from the dead. And then in Acts 26:23, it says that the Christ would suffer, that he would be the first to rise from the dead and would proclaim light to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. So I was just wondering, like, why is Jesus called the firstborn from the dead? And how is he the firstborn, like, from the dead, since, like people were raised from the dead in the Old Testament and the New Testament?
Very good question. Jesus is the firstborn from the dead in two ways, maybe more, but these two ways. That number one, firstborn means the position of heir, because in the Jewish community, the firstborn was the one born first, but occasionally the firstborn wasn't the one born first. It was the other one that God sovereignly chose, and that one was called the firstborn. And so the firstborn means the heir. So Jesus is the firstborn, as in the elder brother, the heir of everything. So it means heir. Then secondly, he's the first man with a resurrected body, not the first man raised from the dead. Because Lazarus was raised from the dead, but he died later. So he had to die twice. So he got raised from the dead, but he did not have a resurrected body. The big difference, Jesus is the first human being with a fully resurrected body in the full capacity. So he's the firstborn from the dead in that way. Good question.
Hi, my name is Alex. I have a two-part question. I want to know, first of all, in chapter 12, if you think the child is Jesus. And also, it says two times in that chapter that the woman went to her place in the wilderness. And I'd like to know if that is like the first time she goes in the first half of, you know, the first 3.5 years, and then the second time is the second 3.5 years. And like in the middle of that, is that when Satan falls from heaven?
In Revelation 12, verse 1 to 5, it gives the picture, and it says it's symbolic. So when the book of Revelation says it's symbolic, which it does about 10 times it says that passage is, then you know it's symbolic. When it doesn't indicate it's symbolic, then it's straightforward. It means what it says and says what it means. That's one of the places, though, Revelation 12, 1 to 5, where it says it is symbolic. Okay, it makes it clear. It's a symbol. I think the child is clearly Jesus. So I feel very strong about that. The woman is the remnant of Israel. And the woman goes into the wilderness in the end times. Now the question is, does the woman go into the wilderness once or twice?
Well, I think I want to know if that represents like two separate floods of persecution.
I think it's
Israel.
One, personally.
Like the
I've never thought of it as two. I'd have to read it again and go, huh, that's a different angle. Because the common thought is it's 1 3.5-year period, but it's always worth reading again, you know.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I'm Karina from Philippines. I'm just wondering if when the marriage of the Lamb will actually take place. Is it after the procession, before the millennium? And then second question is, when you had received the mandate to establish the house of prayer, was your scholar knowledge about end times was already set, or was it something evolving through the years?
Very good question. I'll answer the second one first. My knowledge, I've had about 10 or 15 main points about the end times I've held for 30 years. Like I'm 53 now. When I was 23, I was just looking at my handouts. I made handouts when I was 23. I mean, those poor people. But I was looking at it. Matter of fact, my secretary from way back then visited just a few weeks ago on Saturday night, and she gave me a bunch of my old handouts, and so it was kind of fun. And so I still have those handouts, and the 10 or 15 main points that I believe today, I had then, 30 years ago. Now, because of teaching it every Friday and Saturday night for the last 7 years now. We started in September 2002, so it's 7 years in September, teaching it every Saturday night and having lots of discussions. We have a lot of our main Bible teachers, about 20 of them. We had every Sunday afternoon for 2 hours. For 3 years, we had debates on all the passages. And the goal was, I would tell them, prove me wrong. And they loved it. They would, this is wrong, that's wrong. I said, but you got to use Bible verses. You can't use tradition. You got to use Bible verses. You can't say, well, my church always said that. That didn't go very far with me. And so for 3 years, 2 hours every Sunday afternoon, right after Saturday night, I would go there with a bunch of our Bible teachers, and they would just go hard after this. And so it was a very interesting 2-3 year period. So I formed a lot of thinking in that period. We haven't done that for 3-4 years, but that was about a 3-year period. So it's formed over time. What was your first question?
When the marriage of the Lamb will actually take place.
It never says in the book of Revelation when the marriage of the Lamb takes place. It never actually, it's unstated, which is like you just want it to be stated, you know, as I do. And it's my opinion, it's not and I try to always distinguish between what I think is a Bible revelation and a Mike Bickle opinion. I like to always distinguish between them. My opinion is that the marriage supper goes for 1,000 years. It's a 1,000-year supper. It goes the entire millennial kingdom. And we're just having a great time for 1,000 years. And Jesus is ruling the nations, and he's involved in the banquet. And it's just a great time. That's an opinion. It might not be true, but whatever it is, it's going to be great. And when does it actually start? I don't quite know. You know, the details of just after that seventh trumpet blast, all bets are off. I mean, you know, let the wedding begin, you know. After that seventh trumpet, anything might happen, but I think it goes clear to the end.
Okay, Covey and Sally from Texas would like to know, has God already determined the date and time of the return of the Lord? And if so, how can the church hasten this day?
Has he determined? Okay, now there's a difference between God knowing the future and God determining all the issues in the future. Okay? Let me say that again. There's a difference between God's foreknowledge and God's predetermination. Like, God knows if I'm going to do something good or bad in a couple years. But he's allowing me to choose. So he's going, I know what you're going to do, but you still choose. And so it's both and. So does the Lord know the date? I certainly assume he does. And how do we have an impact? Because he has such insight on all the factors that are playing. He can see the beginning of the beginning. It's like you might see, this is maybe a bad analogy, you might see a little five-year-old who can play, Bach and Beethoven on the piano. It's just a prodigy, a musical prodigy. 5 years old, playing the most difficult. You could say, I bet when he's 20, he's in music. And say, boy, you are so sharp, Joseph. But the Lord is so smart. Even what's happening with that five-year-old is super obvious where it's going. And so the Lord can still know many things, but still we have a very relevant contribution that matters and that affects the outcome. It's the both and. And that's as heavy as I get on it. And the reason I don't get any more detailed on that, because I picture, you know, my angels standing right here going, now listen, little guy, you got a real little brain and God's got a real big brain. You better go easy. You don't know that much about his brain, so just go soft. So I always have the little guy syndrome, you know, which is a good one. Okay, I think how are we doing it?
We're over here.
Okay, you know what? I got all mixed up. We'll go here and we'll go around this way or I'll get
confused. My name's Austin. And my question was out of Revelation 2:13. It's Jesus talking to the church of Pergamum, and he says, I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. And David Paulson actually spawned the question to me, but does Satan still have a throne on the earth? Is it in Pergamum? If not, where and why?
I don't know if it's in Pergamum. I don't know that. And does Satan have a throne on the earth? I assume, but there's nothing in the Bible that says it. Except for just Jesus said it for that time. So if he had it at one time, the logic is why wouldn't he have it other times? But we know in Revelation 13:2, he gives his throne and his authority to the Antichrist. And the Antichrist is on the earth. That's 13:2. So we know his throne is given to the Antichrist. So I think it's fair to assume it's somewhere on the earth. I don't know. You know, just your guess is good. What do you think?
I thought LA, just because for a couple reasons, just because Hollywood's there, and then I mean, there's
wait,
some,
you have where
LA, California,
oh, LA,
just
because, okay.
And then I don't know, man, you coming in on the
I
plane,
thought you actually said Olay, I thought you said Olay, I actually thought, I don't know what that means, Olay, no. I thought that was kind of the new way of wow, you know. I actually did. I thought, okay, I missed that one. Okay. You go over here.
All right. My name is Johnny. I have two questions. First, as believers, are we supposed to encourage Jewish people to return to their land? And my second question, and during end times, which is now, are we supposed to focus on bringing the gospel to Jews before Gentiles, or does it not matter?
Wow, good question. Okay, now, encouraging the Jews to go to the land. I don't think there is a mandate to all Jews go to the land, because there's too many Jews not in the land in the prophetic scriptures. So I don't have a standard, if you're Jewish, you go to the land. I think one person is supposed to, one is not supposed to. It's just all different. But some will teach, some messianic ministries, which means Jewish ministries who love Jesus, they will teach everyone must go back to the land. I don't see that in the Bible. I don't know. I've heard the exhortation, but I don't find it biblical. But maybe it is. You know, maybe I've never seen a verse that proves it. And again, there's too many verses where they're not in the land. Because one classic one is in Ezekiel 20. Ezekiel chapter 20. I think it's 35 or 25, something like that. It says that in the wilderness of the nations, God meets Israel face to face and brings them into the bond of covenant with himself. So it's not in Israel, it's in the wilderness of the nations. So I think that that's Ezekiel 20. So, what's that? Oh, I thought somebody was giving me the verse there. Okay. So I don't think there's a mandate they go or don't go. I think it's the will of God for one to go and the will of God for one not to go. Do we preach to Jews first? I don't think there's a mandate to do that. I think, again, you preach to who the Lord leads you to preach to. I think it's just that simple. Now, the reason in the first century, the gospel had to be offered to the Jews first. And it was. And I think that offer was made, and it's 2,000 years later. And if you live in a city, it's not like make sure you go to the synagogue first, preach, and then go build a church. I don't think that, because some guys have tried to do that, and because they were, I think they misunderstood the fact that because the gospel belongs to the Jews, it had to go to them in the first century after the day of Pentecost first. But not, I don't think, the 1500s, the 1800s, all that. But if the door opens, of course, go to the Jews. Because they won't all appreciate it. But I think you still go.
Okay, we have a couple questions about the pre-trib rapture. It said, what is the best way to approach a person who is aggressively protective of pre-trib rapture? That's Stephen from the UK. And then Nathan would like to know, what scriptures would you guide me to that show that the pre-trib rapture is wrong and that it'll happen at a later time?
Okay, so tell me the first question.
So it's how would you best approach someone who is protective of the pre-trib rapture?
Okay, first of all, humility. Because if one of the reasons people, if you in a relationship, if you believe it and I don't, you are deceived and you are wrong, already the conversation is going to be strained. Because you love Jesus as much as I love Jesus, and you're deceived and you're wrong and I'm right. That's already, I think that a lot of it is in the attitude and the approach. But the pre-trib rapture, the burden isn't to find the verses that prove it isn't pre-trib. The burden is to find the verses that prove it is. There aren't any. Zero. There isn't one. So when you talk to somebody and you say, where in the Bible does it say pre-trib, there is not one passage. There's one possible passage. And I think you have to stretch it. It's Revelation 3:10. That's the only possible passage that could indicate it. Even the Bible teachers on the pre-trib will tell you, not all of them necessarily, but one of the, I won't name him because I might quote it slightly wrong, and you don't want to quote somebody wrong without doing your homework exactly, but I was awestruck. I was struck with, whoa, one of the main Bible teachers on the pre-trib rapture, written 50 books, president of a seminary, all these kinds of things. Real, 50, 60 books on the end times for 50 years. And he's one of the number one names of the pre-tribulation rapture. And I'm reading his stuff. And he's saying, we have been criticized that there isn't a specific verse that says it. He goes to this, we have to answer, it is right. I went, whoa, there is not one verse that says it explicitly. However, by implication, it says it 10 times. And so by implication, and if you do it by implication, you can get implication. If you interpret the Bible by implication, you could end up anywhere. But he said, actually, in his own book, I got to get it so I can. He said, there is no direct verse that actually says it to that charge. I have to say they're right. So when I talk about humility is the big point, but the problem, the question isn't what verse says it is. The question is what verse says it isn't. What verse says it is? And the primary verse, I don't want to give a teaching on the rapture, but the two of them that strike me right immediately is when at 1 Corinthians 15, verse 51 and 52. 1 Corinthians 15, what's his name?
Stephen.
Stephen, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 51 and 52. It says that the rapture, in essence, will be at the last trumpet. So we know that. It is at the last trumpet. And there's only seven trumpets that are numbered in the book of Revelation. And the last trumpet, the seventh, the kingdoms of the earth become the kingdoms of the Lord at the seventh trumpet. And so it is at the last trumpet, clearly. And the last trumpet, there's only seven mentioned, and they're all numbered, and seven is the last of the seven. So, I mean, I'm not being cute, but, it's pretty straightforward in that regard. And then in Matthew 24, verse 30, Jesus says, when the trumpet goes, then the angels go out and get all of the believers from one end of heaven to the other, and it's after the tribulation. It says it clearly in Matthew 24, verse 30. These things happen immediately after the tribulation of those days. The trumpet blows, and the angels go get all of the saints from the four corners and bring them to Jesus. And so, Matthew 24, 30. Those are just really clear, obvious ones. And the pre-tribulation rapture, I'll say this one last thing, is only been a doctrine since 1830. The pre-tribulation rapture was not a doctrine for 2,000 years of church history. If you would ask somebody in the 1400s, the 800s, a scholar, pre-tribulation rapture, they would have gone blank on you. It happened, a woman in Scotland had a vision in 1830 of the pre-tribulation rapture, and a couple teachers, John Darby and Scofield, got a hold of it and made it famous. And so it was a brand new concept. In 1830, it was a heresy to most people. By about 1930, it became established, but mostly only in America. It's not a doctrine.